Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with How Stuff Works and iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And it's time for another classic episode. This one's truly dated. This one came out on November 7th, 2012. It is titled Tech Stuff Jumps from Space. And yes, this was when we were talking about a space jump, when a capsule that was raised up by very strong balloons was taken to the very edge of space, and we got to experience what it was like to jump out of it as we watched in first-person view, and it was absolutely exhilarating or terrifying, depending on your point of view. In this episode, Chris and I talk about that entire mission and what it took to achieve it. Hope you guys enjoy.
Earlier this week, as of the time we're recording this, a fellow named Felix Baumgartner did something pretty phenomenal.
Yes.
Actually, I think he fell.
Yeah. Nice.
He fell a lot.
Yeah.
He fell more than any man has ever fallen before.
Right. In space, no one can hear you fall.
Yeah, that's true.
As a matter of fact, you know, you said that it's been in the news. I think this is going to captivate people's attention for a long, long time. Because yeah. I don't know that anybody is ready to better this brand new record he set.
And this record was set more than, 40 years after the last one.
Yeah.
So it's been a while. What we're talking about is the Red Bull Stratos jump.
Yes.
So, sponsored by Red Bull, was this crazy attempt to break some world records. And many world records were broken, actually three. Three mm-hmm. out of the four that they were aiming for,
mm-hmm.
They broke. If you're curious about the one they did not break, it was for longest free fall. And I think they were going by longest as in time. really, mm-hmm. they were looking at the time. It's kind of interesting because according to what they were going by, the person who had the record for the highest jump previously, which was an Air Force, United States Air Force colonel named Joseph Kittinger.
Mm-hmm. And, I heard his name pronounced Kittinger on the news report that I
okay.
saw. I don't know that that's...
Kittinger.
I don't know.
At any rate, he did several jumps for the Air Force to kind of test, you know, what this how could a human survive in a high altitude jump?
Mm-hmm.
And one of those jumps, he fell for 4 minutes and 36 seconds before deploying his main chute. However, he did use a drogue chute, which is a smaller chute not meant to slow you to the safe speed, but rather to help guide your descent, because mm-hmm. we'll get into why that's important. But he had that deployed in his jump. However, if you're really going to be a stickler, then 2 years later, that was in 1960, 2 years later, so 1962, Eugene Andreev jumped from an altitude of around 83,523 feet, which is around 25,457 meters, over Russia, and he fell for 80,380 feet, or 24,500 meters, before deploying his chute without using a drogue chute. So, depending on the way you look at it, his is the longest free fall because there was no drogue chute deployed. Anyway, Baumgartner's fall did not last that long before deploying his chute. It was 4 minutes 22 seconds, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So he did not break that record. However, other records he definitely did break. And it was a remarkable achievement on multiple fronts. I mean, just human endurance to be able to handle that kind of battering about you get in a jump of that size, as well as the technical achievements that we made in order to make this possible. So we wanted to talk a little bit about why this is such a challenging thing to take on, mm-hmm. and the kind of stuff he used to achieve it. And of course, this was a huge effort. I mean, this is not one guy going up in a plane and jumping out and deploying a chute. I mean, there was a huge team in place to bring this about.
Mm-hmm. And of course, as Jonathan has already mentioned, this is not an effort that was backed by a government. This was completely private.
Yep.
Which, you know, in some respects makes things easier. And yes, they didn't use any kind of spacecraft. They did have a pressurized capsule,
yep.
that was lifted into place by a very, very tall balloon.
Yeah, actually, the balloon got less tall as it got further up in the atmosphere because of the changes in pressure. In fact, that's probably the first thing we should talk about is the air pressure and why there were so many things needing to be in place in order for him to have a successful jump. Air pressure changes at elevations, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So. It makes sense. You figure when you think about the Earth and you think about the atmosphere around the Earth, well, if you're on the surface of the Earth, you've got more atmosphere above you pressing down on you than you would if you were, quite a bit of the ways up.
Mm-hmm.
And so at sea level, you have one atmosphere of pressure. Now, if you're wondering, well, what does that mean in terms of, other units, that's just under 15 pounds per square inch, and you're welcome, Europe, that I did this, 1.03 kilograms per square centimeter. But one atmosphere is a much easier way of saying that. So that's at sea level, and that's the average.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so even at sea level, that number changes somewhat, but the average is that number.
Okay.
Now, at 35,000 feet, which is, around where a lot of commercial air flights might be, somewhere around in that area,
yeah.
Which is 10,700 meters. See, I did this all the way around. It's about 3.5 pounds per square inch. So
mm-hmm.
remember, at sea level, 15 pounds, 35,000 feet, around 3.5 pounds. That, by the way, is 0.25 kilograms per square centimeter. or 0.24 atmospheres. At around 62,000 feet or 19,000 meters, the pressure has reached a point where it's so so much less than what we experience that we can have some pretty serious health risks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've evolved on this planet to be able to survive in the conditions of our environment. So, you know, we're used to having this certain amount of air pressure. Beyond that, we don't do so well. And if the pressure is too light, then our blood can actually start to have gas form within it, and then will expand. Which is called ebullism,
mm-hmm.
and it is not a good thing to have happen to you. So that's why pressure is a big deal. And of course, we haven't even reached the height of the where the jump was, because the goal for this jump was to jump out at around 120,000 feet. In actuality, he got all the way up to around 128,100 feet, which is 39,045 meters, which is just over 24 miles up, or 39 kilometers for those of you who wanted to, you know, not divide that number of meters there. It took about 2 hours for him to get there. But at that elevation, air pressure is less than 1 pound per square inch, or less than 0.07 kilograms per square centimeter, or 0.07 atmospheres. So you're talking about very little air pressure at all. And because of that, both the capsule he was in and, of course, the suit he was wearing needed to be pressurized so that he would not have any major health risks when he jumped out, or just mm-hmm. from the ascent. So the capsule was pressurized first, and it was done that way so that he would not have to pressurize his suit from the ground as they started to ascend. By having it in the capsule, it took some of that energy that was needed off the actual suit, which is good. You want to preserve that as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Once they reached the float height, which is where the balloon was not going to rise any higher, it had mm-hmm. gone as high as it was going to go, then that was when it was time to open up the door and start off the jump. Well, that's where they had to depressurize the cabin and pressurize the suit. Actually, mm-hmm. pressurize the suit first, obviously.
Right, yes.
Very important step. But then depressurize the cabin so that they could open up the door. You can't open that door otherwise. There's too much pressure on the inside. It's just like if you're in an airplane and you have the emergency exit. The emergency exit, if you are at altitude, it's going to have so much tremendous amount of pressure on the inside because the airplane itself is pressurized while the outside is not. You can't open that door. Mm-hmm. You're just not physically strong enough. Same thing here. Once it was depressurized, he could open up the door. His suit had been pressurized. And that was what gave him that safety of, at least from the environment. I mean, there's so many other things you have to worry about, but as far as air pressure goes, that was how they took care of that. And of course, all the different parts of his suit were sealed so that there wouldn't be any leaks. Like the gloves had these rotating locks on them so that you could have them airtight with the suit as well as the helmet. This was really important because Kittinger had a jump where he had a hole in one of his gloves. And apparently the glove ended up for the pressure, it ended up sticking to his hand enough so that it wasn't a huge problem. And he did not report this to ground control because of fear that they would cancel the jump. But by the time he landed, there was a problem. His hand started to swell and apparently swelled to about twice the size of normal, due to the changes in pressure and so that's something you don't want to have happen
mm-hmm.
if you can avoid it.
That's true. Yeah, the suit was actually made by a company from Massachusetts, David Clark.
Yep. They made suits for the Gemini missions, as well as space shuttle missions, Gemini missions.
If that sounds like an internal joke, it sort of is.
You got to listen to some of our previous space podcasts.
We did a series on the Gemini missions a few years ago, and one of the astronauts from that time kept pronouncing it Gemini, and Jonathan's blood pressure just kept rising every time he said it.
Jiminy Cricket. Yeah. So it was same company that did that.
They've made all kinds of suits for aeronautics and space for decades now.
Yep.
So they're a well known, well respected firm to have done that, and obviously. Since the jump was successful, no spoilers intended, but it's nice to know.
I was about to say, who can't really spoil something that already happened?
If somebody's like just now hearing about this,
yeah, well,
then you have been hiding in a hole.
You can watch this live when it happened, and from about an hour into it, I turned it on after it had been on for an hour because the ascent took just over 2 hours to get to the right altitude. So,
Jonathan told me about how he felt when Bumgardner opened the capsule door and started to step out. They call him Fearless Felix. That's the nickname he has.
Sheer terror was what was going through me. Yes. Seeing his, we'll get into it. But to go back to the suit, it also could withstand temperatures as low as minus 90 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 68 Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
Or over 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 37.8 degrees Celsius. So also very important because, of course, at that elevation, you were also talking about very, very cold temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there were parts of his fall that were colder than others. It was interesting because it actually warmed up a little bit from I forget
friction?
No, not friction. I'm just talking about the ambient temperature.
Oh, sorry.
Actually warmed up. Like there was a point in the atmosphere. Yeah, no, I was watching and they talked about it too. They said, well, you're closer to the sun. I'm like, really? You're not that much closer. The sun's 93 million miles away. I think a few feet isn't a huge difference.
No, I imagine not.
But it was interesting. You could watch, and the temperature gauge was going up. It went really low and then started creeping up again, just slightly. It wasn't like skyrocketing. But at the height where he was jumping, the temperature was around minus 10 Fahrenheit, which is minus 23 Celsius. So
I blame cows.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Methane production? Is that what you're talking about? Okay. I was trying to see where you're going there.
Note, not based on scientific fact, mostly because I just wanted to say cows.
Gotcha. So, so the suit had to be able to withstand these cold temperatures as well. And his suit also had it looked a lot like the spacesuits you would see, in any NASA presentation, or if you've watched any of those launches, it looks a lot like those.
Actually, it also looked a little bit, just from appearances sake, sort of like the stuff that race car drivers wear.
Yeah.
Probably mostly because the names and the decals and things.
Right. Yeah. So, it also had,
sponsors.
It also had a sun visor that Felix could put down or up if he needed to. And the visor itself was heated in order to have it avoid icing issues. If you're going through super cold temperatures and we give off a lot of water vapor, as it turns out, and there could be a lot of icing problems both on the inside and outside of a suit. And in fact, that was one of the issues that almost seemed to be a big problem during the ascent, because it looked like, according to Felix, that the faceplate was not heating properly.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think the first time I heard about that was when he was around 80,000 feet or so and still rising, obviously still climbing. And then you hear the people who are speaking during the whole ascent, the people who are relaying information to the audience saying, everyone here is trying to find out what options we have. And I'm like, wow, what options do you have? And the option, the biggest, last ditch option thing, in order to get him back to Earth safely, you ditch the jump.
Right.
But the capsule itself was connected to the balloon and could disconnect and had its own parachute.
Yeah.
So the worst case scenario action would be to cut the tie to the balloon, mm-hmm. to deploy the parachute on the capsule and have the capsule come down to Earth. Now, that was not ideal. First of all, you're aborting the jump, so that's not ideal. But right. also, it would have been a bit of a rough landing. Now, the capsule itself had crash sections built into it, crash mm-hmm. pads, to absorb some of that impact if it were to have to land. Now, and of course, they did detach the capsule at the end of the jump anyway because they wanted to retrieve the capsule. But it definitely would not have been a soft landing.
Yeah.
It would have been a little rough. And it's interesting because the inside of the capsule, again, looked very much like the Gemini capsules. It was a tiny little thing, really. The capsule was 6 feet tall, or 1.8 meters, mm-hmm. and it weighed 2,900 pounds, or 1,315 kilograms. And you take a look at this, and you're like, wow, this looks like it would fit, in a special casing on the top of a rocket. It really did look like some of those early NASA spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. True enough. So, should we talk about the jump?
Sure. There are other things. Actually, before we talk about the jump, I want to talk about the balloon.
Oh, the balloon.
Okay. I want to talk about the balloon because the balloon is crazy. Yes, so
it has its own story. Actually, five or so of them.
Well, the weird thing I thought, the strangest thing to me about the balloon was how incredibly thin that material was.
Yeah.
So it was made out of polyethylene plastic film,
mm-hmm.
and it was 0.0008 inches thick.
That's pretty thin.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty thin. Or 0.0002 or 0.0002 centimeters thick. There we go.
All right.
We're going to get that number right. But yeah, super, super thin. They called it a 40-acre dry cleaner bag. Because it was essentially made out of very similar stuff. Now, if you're thinking, like, how could that possibly bear the weight of this capsule, which, weighs quite a bit, the way they did it was they used this load tape that mm-hmm. was connected to the balloon, and the load tape was actually what bore the load of the capsule.
Right.
The tape also had in it a special reflective material so that the balloon would show up on radar.
Mm-hmm.
Very important for any aircraft in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Although, of course, the mission was working along with air traffic controllers to make sure there wouldn't be any problems on that. Because, you can't really direct where a balloon's going to go.
Right, right.
You are at the mercy of the winds.
Mm-hmm. Although this was over the desert in the southwestern United States.
Yeah, it was near.
So there weren't a lot of populated areas.
Right, near Roswell, New Mexico. So it was really just the military and aliens
right.
that were there.
Exactly.
By the way, I'm totally joking. The whole Roswell alien thing is absolutely ludicrous. But anyway, and that balloon was created by ATA Aerospace.
Mm-hmm.
And here's some stats on the balloon. Some for people who are curious about how big this was. Yeah. So uninflated, it was 592.41 feet long, or 180.6 meters. Now, at the height, once it was inflated, which takes about an hour, to inflate this balloon with helium. They used helium because it's non-flammable. Very important.
If you've been wondering why there's a helium shortage.
Yeah. Yeah, talk about...
Because that's a big balloon to fill
up. That's a big balloon to fill up with helium, yeah. Yeah, the LHC might have a few things to say to Felix.
Have to explain to your kid why she can't get a Dora balloon.
Yeah.
Now you know. Blame it on Felix.
So, just get that Dora balloon filled with hydrogen. I can't imagine anything bad happening from that.
Take it to a birthday party.
Don't do that. Hydrogen is highly flammable. That's why they went with helium.
Blow out the candles.
So... The height of the balloon, once it was fully inflated at takeoff, was about 550 feet, or 167.6 meters. And once it reached its altitude, the height was more like 334.82 feet, or 102.1 meters. Because, again, as it got higher up in the atmosphere, as the atmospheric pressure decreased, the balloon started to the height began to decrease, but its diameter increased. They began to round out quite a bit. Because when you first looked at it, it looked like a teardrop.
Yeah, it was kind of tall and skinny, really, compared to what we think of when we do think of birthday party balloons. You know, I mean, those are teardrop shaped too, but not – this is a lot longer than that.
Right. So once it got up to the
– got mushroomier.
Yeah. It definitely rounded out as it got higher up. And uninflated, it weighed a svelte 3,708 pounds or 1,682 kilograms.
You just wanted to say svelte.
I did. And and it also had a vent so that it could vent off helium. Now, this is also really important.
You know what bugs me?
No,
those other balloons, I think they're...
No, it didn't vent anger. It vented helium. Yeah, now the reason for the vent is very important because the helium was expanding as the balloon was climbing, right? So there does come a point where there's a possibility that that expansion could damage the balloon itself and tear the balloon. So the balloon needed to have a way of venting out excess helium in order to avoid that. And in fact, they did vent helium at least once or twice, especially once they passed that 120,000 feet mark, because that, again, was their goal, and they went right by it and kept on going. There was a point where there was some concern about making sure that the balloon and capsule maintained integrity.
Yeah.
Because it was starting to go beyond what they had planned. So
as long as they didn't run into any wire coat hangers, because that seems to be the downfall of most dry cleaner bags.
Right. Yeah. That's exactly the problem.
I'm teasing.
Jonathan from 2019 here to interrupt this classic episode. Before we take any more leaps, we're going to take a quick jump over to a break to thank our sponsor.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
They had 9 high-definition cameras that were mounted on both the suit and on and inside the capsule. So they had cameras mounted on these arms pointed back at the capsule, so you could get these great views of the capsule as it was going up. Also, as the door opened, which that's the part where I was terrified, and I'll talk about that in a second. But there were also cameras on the suit, so they could capture footage during the actual jump.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, beyond that, they had a helicopter that was using a camera mounted on a stabilization gyroscope to track Felix's movements. Mm-hmm. And they had ground cameras on these huge trucks with these enormous bases that were motorized, so they could track the progress of the balloon. And it's phenomenal to me, because you think – that's a balloon that is more or less 24 miles up in the air.
Yeah.
So to have a camera that can capture something that's that far away is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, you think about that for a second. You're like, well, yeah, I've got a digital zoom on my camera.
Yeah.
It goes up to 1.7. And well, this camera can capture something that's 24 miles away.
Well, tracking the balloon was a whole lot easier than tracking Felix after he stepped out of the capsule.
Right. He's much, first of all, he doesn't have all that reflective. He's smaller. Although not that much smaller. It's a 6-foot tall capsule.
He was also moving a whole lot faster.
Yes. Cause he was going downwards.
Mm-hmm.
That was definitely, I mean, the footage that they captured was pretty phenomenal. And especially when you sit there and think about the challenges involved. And beyond that, not just capturing the footage, but transmitting the footage, getting that live feed from the capsule, you're thinking, wow, they had to dedicate a lot of bandwidth, in order to get that information from the capsule to the ground and stream it out live. And in fact, they had 3 dedicated video downlinks with built-in redundancy to get that information down to the ground. Mm-hmm. And then they had a fiber optic network on the ground to process that information, and they had live switching so they could switch, different cameras at different times to give the best angle or the best camera experience at any given moment.
Yeah.
Which was pretty, it was clearly something that the whole media side of it was, there was a lot of thought put toward it, which
well,
is,
sure.
That's
the age we're living in.
Yeah. So, getting to the actual jump, once they got to the point where they had reached the right altitude, they had to go through a very long checklist to make sure that everything was prepared before the jump. And that involved pressurizing the suit, disconnecting the suit from the capsule, because the capsule had its own oxygen supply, because again, at that elevation, the atmosphere is so thin that we would not be able to breathe up there. So the capsule had its own oxygen supply, and then the suit did as well. So you had to detach the suit from the capsule, because clearly you can't jump if you're still got all these hoses connected.
Well, you can, but it's not recommended.
No, it would not go well. So there was that. There was the whole depressurization, opening up the door, moving the chair around quite a bit. The chair inside the capsule could move forward and backward a little so that he could reach various controls.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the point where he had to move the chair back. He had depressurized the capsule, pressurized the suit. The door had opened, and then they used an exterior camera to capture the moment where he moves. He's lifted his feet up so they're above the threshold of the little capsule door.
Mm-hmm.
And then he moves the chair forward, which means his feet come out of the doorway and over nothing. And that's where I freaked out. At that point, he had to stand on a platform that was about the size of an average skateboard.
Yeah, looked like it.
Yeah, and there he is in a spacesuit, standing on a skateboard-sized platform, holding on to these rails that are on either side of the capsule door.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And once he had the go-ahead, he let go and started falling, and I don't think I breathed until until he stopped spinning. So here's one of the issues about jumping at that height. So again, atmosphere is really thin, mm-hmm. right? You don't immediately start to slow down. In fact, the atmosphere is so thin that you will go faster than you would if you jumped from any other height. Like, you know, you don't have anything pushing against you, or not as much pushing against you, because there is atmosphere out there. It's just not mm-hmm. as much. It's in the stratosphere at this point.
Yeah, yeah. And in case you're wondering, I happened to catch a news report in which they had asked him, and Felix said that he didn't look down. He was looking straight out, which at that altitude, I'm not sure how you could avoid it, because the Earth is – you could see the
curvature the, of the Earth.
The curvature of the Earth, and you're going, okay, that's sort of down.
That's something else that's kind of interesting, is that the curvature – you can see it at that altitude, mm-hmm. but if you look at the footage from the jump, mm-hmm. the curvature is incredibly evident. Like it's obvious. The reason it's obvious is because of the camera lens.
Yeah.
It's a wide angle camera lens. So it artificially has bent the edges. So it looks like the curvature is much more, much further up than it really was. But in reality that you could from what I've been told, you can see the curvature at that altitude. It's just not as dramatic as what it appeared as on the live stream. So mm-hmm. just wanted to point that out.
Yeah. But at that altitude, he moved very quickly into a very fast speed, 32 feet per second per second, or 9.754 meters per second squared.
That's the acceleration of gravity, people. If you are at all interested in physics, you will memorize that and use it all the time.
Yep. So he rapidly increased to that speed.
Yeah. His top speed is estimated, because at the time of the recording of this podcast, we do not have the final information, but his top speed was estimated at 833.9 miles per hour, or 1,342.8 kilometers per hour.
Mach 1.24.
Yeah, so Mach being the speed of sound. He had broken the sound barrier, the first human to do so unaided by any sort of vehicle.
Yes, and that's another interesting point. The interview with the scientist that I had watched said that the speed of sound is a little different at that altitude too.
Right. Sound travels, you know, the speed of sound is dependent upon the medium through which it's traveling. Mm-hmm. Sound will travel at a different rate of speed depending on if you are in, it'll travel at a different rate of speed from sea level to 120,000 feet. It travels at a different rate if it's through water or through a solid. So, it's one of the, and in fact, we should, might as well, this is a little bit of a tangent, but light's the same way. Mm-hmm. Light travels at, you've heard of the speed of light being a constant. That's
right.
True, but that's talking about the speed of light in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
The speed of light will change depending on what it's traveling through. Now, most of the time for us as human beings, that change is imperceptible to mm-hmm. us without incredibly sensitive measuring equipment. So to us, it's, going at the speed of light, or just a hair under the speed of light, is mm-hmm. effectively the same thing for us.
Yeah. And I've tried to observe that myself at my home, but I keep getting dust in my eye every time I open that little bag. And it doesn't seem like there's any light in there at all, but it may be the dust. I can't tell.
Oh, right. Inside your vacuum.
Yes.
I got you now. So you should go with a Dyson that's the bagless.
It's clear.
Yeah. Chris and I are going to freak out a little bit more about jumping out of a capsule in space. But before we get to that, let's take another quick break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
It's funny because when you get the idea of somebody jumping out of an airplane, you're doing a traditional skydive. Most of us have a pretty good idea of what that quote unquote looks like. You stand in the door, you jump out of the plane, and you instantly put out your arms and legs and you just sort of glide until you feel like it's time to open your chute. Then you pull it and go. Well, Felix wasn't as graceful, but it wasn't his fault.
Yeah.
See, as it turns out, that whole atmosphere being thinner thing kind of affects the way you fall at that height.
He couldn't use air resistance to help orient himself, because that's one thing. Experienced skydivers can do all sorts of really cool maneuvers.
Yeah.
While they're diving, and it's all due to the whole air resistance and being able to use their bodies to angle in certain ways. Either they can do try to resist or change their wind resistance, like reduce it to a point where they're falling very, very, very fast.
Yes.
Or they can try to increase their wind resistance by increasing the surface area as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. They can do somersaults and other kinds of tricks.
But at that altitude, there wasn't enough air, not enough atmosphere,
right,
to be able to do that. So there wasn't there wasn't that level of control. And so Felix did start spinning. And if you watch the video, that also was terrifying because you could see him spinning around and around. And you're like, okay, I sure hope he's able to maintain consciousness, not black out. Because Kittinger said, you know, he blacked out during his fall.
Yeah.
Because of a similar issue. And that's why the drogue chute was so important, was to – it was actually – I think it was not the 102,000-foot – jump, but the previous one that Kittinger did, mm-hmm. where he blacked out. And so that's why the drogue chute was so important for him in his highest jump.
Yeah.
Well, you could see that spinning happening. But then once he did start hitting the next levels where the atmosphere was starting to increase in density, he was able to orient himself into a traditional skydive position.
The delta position.
Yeah.
I've heard it called.
And is that what it's called? That's interesting. I've never gone skydiving, so I know very little about it. Although, and internet, this is just between me and you. Do not tell my wife because she would flip out. But I am planning on doing a skydiving jump possibly during CES 2013.
You are not.
I am.
Really?
Yeah, me and Ayaz Akhtar of This Week in Tech are thinking about doing some skydiving during CES 2013.
Are you going to parachute into the
Las Vegas Convention Center? Doubtful. It'll be much further out into the desert. But don't tell my wife because she would flip out. Okay? Pinky swear.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, yeah, he assumed that position, and then that was the point where I said, oh, good. Well, then he's clearly conscious, and he's aware of what's going on, and he's able to respond. He deployed his chute at the appropriate time, and that was a big – that got a big cheer from mm-hmm. ground control. And did you watch any of the video of his landing?
Oh yeah.
It was a perfect landing.
Absolutely.
It was like he just stepped off a step.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't like he just came from 128,000 feet. It was like he had just walked down a set of stairs.
Yeah. I would have looked like a sack of potatoes from a 20 foot jump.
I would have been dragged. At least another few hundred meters. I'm sure.
He's an accomplished jumper. He's an accomplished base jumper, which is, jumping off of, ironically enough, it's, lower altitudes, bridges and all sorts of other different physical features. You wouldn't try this at home anyway, but yeah. I mean, this is not something from that an inexperienced person did. He's, clearly a well accomplished jumper and it was an absolutely perfect landing. And then as soon as he, came to a stop, he went down on his knees and put his hands up in the air like, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
I had made the comment of if I had done that, I would have made the decision. I am never leaving the ground again. From now on, people bring stuff to me.
Yeah.
I did my part.
It's like, I'm not going back over the ocean. You bring that continent
here. I want to go to London. Bring London here.
No, it was an absolutely amazing, amazing feat. And it does have a lot of, importance. You might not necessarily believe that.
Right. You might think of it as simply some sort of stunt. Yeah. But going beyond that, I mean, there are, first of all, this kind of is a proof of concept of something that NASA was talking about in the 60s when they were thinking about if there were a problem with a spacecraft, would it be possible for astronauts to space dive back to Earth? Would there be any way they could do that? Or is that just outside the realm of our abilities? And they theorized that it would be possible, but they were never able to test it. Mm-hmm. Kittinger's jumps were kind of related to that. And a lot of the data that they collected during this jump, there was stuff that they could put toward developing more safety features for astronauts as well as space tourists, because whoever thought that would become a thing, but now it is, you know?
Well, I saw some people talking about the space shuttle program and, of course, the two famous disasters.
Right.
One of the people that has been working on this is, the husband of one of the people who perished in the Columbia accident. They were too high to have done something like this. They were moving. They were too far out from the planet when the accident happened, and they were moving way too fast. Something like Mach 17, I think I remember reading. Yeah, it was Dr. Jonathan Clark, who was a former NASA flight surgeon. His wife Laurel died in that accident. So, you know, he was involved in the process of going through the safety procedures here. He's dedicated his life to working on better safety in space. And, you know, as far as the Challenger incident, well, it's sort of unclear whether they would have been able to get out or not. Of course, some of the procedures they developed for the space shuttle were after that as a result of that accident. So, but, you know, in the future, depending on the different kinds of missions that are undertaken, you know, either by NASA or another government space agency or by private enterprise, you know, I think that this information could prove useful, you know, in an emergency or, you know, perhaps as a form of space tourism. I don't know.
Well, and just learning what the effects are of these, the things that Felix experienced during this whole jump. I mean, everything from breaking the sound barrier, that no one was really sure what would happen to a person. And in fact, to be fair, as of the recording of this podcast, we cannot be certain that he did break that barrier because the final numbers haven't come in. He had a, did you see how he would know if he broke the sound barrier? So he has a chest plate, or he had a chest plate on his suit that contained a lot of different sensors, telemetry, you know, information, GPS, all this kind of stuff. If the sensors detected that the suit had exceeded the speed of sound, it would send a ringtone to his helmet. But he said he was concentrating so hard on what was going on that he totally did not, he didn't notice anything. So it may have gone off or it may not have gone off, and he doesn't know, because he was, you know, at that point, I'm kind of just really paying attention to what's going on, especially once, you know, he came out of that spin.
Yeah.
So
I'm flying here.
Yeah. I got, hey lady, I'm flying here. Yeah. But yeah, there are a lot of things that this could help with, including designing new types of spacesuits that are, effective and are not as, you know, we can always make advances in that realm. We don't want it to be so clunky that you can't maneuver around within the confines of a space vehicle.
Yeah.
But it still has to have the adequate levels of protection necessary to maintain the health and safety of our astronauts.
Yeah.
So that's an important thing to keep in mind too. Now, granted, I don't think most of our, space suits will necessarily have sponsor logos on them, but
or maybe they will.
Maybe they will. I was disappointed that the spacesuit didn't have wings.
Well, it was interesting too to compare, and you know, I'm going in my head here, looking at the suits that they wore in NASA launches from the 1960s and 70s, were so much bulkier than this. Well, I mean, they were intended for different purposes, but I imagine the equipment in this newer suit was far more advanced than what Kittinger wore.
Yeah.
On his jumps, and you know, with the technology advances, you know, it's funny that in a way they resemble more what Hollywood suggests for, you know, space fighter pilots than from what the astronauts, the actual astronauts from our own planet. Back in the days when that was so common.
I look forward to the day when we have space suits for space jumps that are like the ones in the documentary Star Trek.
Yeah.
Not the original motion picture Star Trek, but the J.J. Abrams documentary Star Trek.
Yeah.
The J.J. Abrams documentary Star Trek : The Lens Flare.
It caught me off guard.
So, yeah, do you have anything else you wanted to talk about this jump in particular? It was a really neat thing to watch live, and Twitter was going bonkers as this was happening. I saw so many people I know tweeting about this, and it just seemed like there was an overall sense of excitement and not, I was not the only terrified person on Earth watching this.
No.
And you can watch the entire presentation as well. It's up online, so you can go and watch, or you can watch segments of it if you don't have, you know, 2.5 hours to burn. But, it's definitely something amazing. It's one of those moments in human achievement where you think, wow, it never would have occurred to me that this is something that anyone would want to do. And right. if they wanted to do it, I can't imagine it being possible. And yet both of those things happened.
Yep. It was an amazing event, and I'm glad it ended so well.
Yes, definitely.
Picture perfect.
Yep. It was so many different things could have gone wrong. I'm glad a lot of really smart people worked on this to make sure it went off without any major glitches.
Yeah.
So my hat is off to you.
And there we have our classic Tech Stuff episode. Hope you guys enjoyed it. It was interesting to go back and look at this moment in history, which I think a lot of people kind of forget about now. I mean, things change so fast. We have so many things dominating the news cycle that sometimes it can be hard to remember these sort of pivotal, exciting moments where the world was watching as someone did something truly extraordinary. So it was fun to go back and look at this. If you have suggestions for future episodes of Tech Stuff, you can reach out to me with the email techstuff@howstuffworks.com, or you can pop on over to our website. That's techstuffpodcast.com. That has an archive of all of our past episodes. You can find links to where we are on social media, and you can also find a link to our online store where every purchase you make goes to help the show. We greatly appreciate it, and I will talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.